Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. There's no way around the calendar, but isn't it tantalizing to think about being 60 but looking and feeling 50 or even 30? Modern medicine gives us a great shot at living decades longer than our grandparents could take for granted. It has not been quite as successful at ensuring our quality of life in those final years. Dying at 90 after a decade of suffering may not be preferable to dying at 80. But if science can fulfill the promise of extending our vitality, my guest is convinced most of us would jump at the chance for more time. Ronald Bailey is science correspondent for Reason magazine, where his cover story, Eternal Youth for All, appears in the March issue. He also has a book coming out this summer called The End of Doom, Environmental Renewal in the 21st Century. Ronald, welcome to Think.
Delighted to be with you. Thank you for having me.
So given the chance, most people would pick a long life over a short one. But living to be very old and very helpless and very sick is not anybody's dream. We want eternal youth, despite what the calendar says. How do you define youth?
Well, basically, everyone knows who is alive has been youthful, and that's exactly what you want to be, is to feel like you were 20 or 30 again, if you could do that. That is when you're at the peak of your health. That's when you have the illnesses that you might encounter are more easily cured. It's basically, as I say, everybody knows what youth would be and would really long for it if they could have it again.
So in order to move toward extending the years we spend feeling healthy and productive, we need to find ways to prevent illness rather than treat it as it emerges. Is that about right?
I don't think preventing illness is a way to do that, but time marches on anyway. Basically, what happens is that, as our cells, our bodies age, our cells also age over time. Our stem cells become less able to replenish the tissues, our tissues and our organs and so forth. And that just happens over time as our cells divide. There is a set number of times cells might divide. And as you get to that limit, you get older just naturally. So it's not just illness. What you really want to avoid is what you want to avoid is having your cells grow older over time.
And there have been some surprising revelations in what might do this, including the effects of immunosuppressant drugs and things for diabetes that were not invented for these purposes.
Right. For example, experiments on mice feeding them rapamycin, which is an immunosuppressant drug, or metformin, which is a drug used for diabetes, basically increases the lifespan of mice by about 15%. And apparently what it does is help cells repair themselves so that they don't age as rapidly as they would normally.
Okay, explain this for us. Our risk of cancer, we all know, tends to rise as we get older. And the way that cells age may actually be a trade-off to protect us from cancer?
Right. Basically, one way to think about it is, and I believe that the various physiologists have told me this in the past, is if you live long enough, you will get cancer. It's just inevitable as part of the aging process. Again, what we have is in our chromosomes, we have basically little caps on them called telomeres. And the telomeres, every time your cells replicate, they get shorter over time. And as they get shorter and shorter, they get to the point where they basically signal the cell to stop dividing. And they do that basically, it's thought, to prevent the cells from becoming cancerous. At that point, the cells become senescent. They don't divide anymore. And they also releasing substances which tell other cells around them that they're old as well and speed up the aging process. So essentially this shortening of telomeres is a way of preventing cells from becoming cancerous, but it also is the trade-off it makes us older.
So would there be some possibility of removing those senescent cells as they are turned off by our short telomeres?
Yes, actually, that is a technique that is being tried now in mice, and they believe, and some researchers believe, that it will be possible to do that for human beings at some point. Is basically you would target those senescent cells and tell them to die, and therefore they would be eliminated, and they would no longer be producing those substances which could tell other cells that they're old.
How is it that mice are typically used for these experiments? I mean, obviously they're different from humans, but they have, I guess, a nice, typically short lifespan that would allow us to compare?
Right, exactly. Mice tend to live 2 to 3 years, and therefore you're able to tell much more rapidly whether or not these particular treatments are working on them or not. Again, as you point out, though, they are not human beings, and human beings, weirdly, live about 3 times longer than you would expect for creatures our size. It turns out that one way to think about it is that most mammals have a certain number of heartbeats over time. It turns out human beings have 3 times more than you would expect for a mammal our size to have. So we are already fairly youthful, if you will, compared to other species.
Why is inflammation such a culprit in the development of disease?
Right. Inflammation basically is a process of telling cells to divide. It continues to create an environment that basically harms cells and makes them older faster. And that it is a way of also protecting us, obviously, from diseases, but the side effect or the downside of overcoming that disease is that it also ages us a little more rapidly.
All right, I love this. An infusion of young blood might do us some good as we get older. We've all used that expression, but it turns out it may actually work.
Yes. Think of it, if you will, as the vampire cure for aging. Basically, there have been experiments done with, they're called the heterochronic parabiosis, which is a fancy term for basically what some scientists have done at Harvard and Stanford and various other places, is they have connected the circulatory systems of old mice with that of young mice. And it turns out that when you do that, the old mice are rejuvenated. And what they believe is happening is that substances in the young blood are basically restoring the functionality of stem cells in the muscles and the heart and the brains of old mice. And it definitely makes them live a lot longer.
So I just need to find like a college student to tether to myself with an IV of blood?
Well, as it turns out, actually, there is an experiment going on right now in California where they've selected 15 patients who are suffering from dementia, and they are giving them infusions of plasma, blood plasma from people who are under age 35, and the results of that experiment should be forthcoming sometime later this year. But they are really trying to do this. Fortunately, it turns out there may be a substance that can be isolated or even manufactured called GDF11, which is a growth factor, which may be the particular protein that is helping that is responsible for causing this rejuvenation effect. And if that's possible, then we could let the young folk go and just take this particular pill and become younger.
I wonder if it works the other way. I know, or as I understand it, most blood banks take people's blood until they're 65 years old as donor blood. Is that problematic for someone who's very sick in a hospital to get elder blood?
I think if you need blood at that time, you'll be happy to take it no matter what. I don't think that's a problem. But you are right that it turns out that when you're stitching together the old mice with the young mice, it actually ages the young mice much more rapidly. They become older faster because of the substances that are found in the old mice, in the blood of the old mice. So it is a problem.
What can we do to boost the stem cells we do have in our bodies that continue to divide and reproduce over the course of a lifetime?
Well, that's an extremely good question at this point. There are no particular techniques that seem to work. Again, you might try if people are taking – in fact, I know some people who are taking rapamycin because that seems to be what it is doing is rapamycin seems to be restoring the functionality of stem cells. But at the moment, there are no particular techniques for restoring the functionality of your stem cells that's been basically proven by experiment.
For the people who think that extending life might be a mistake, what are the most common objections?
The main problem is that a lot of people are always thinking that what you're doing is creating older people longer. But the whole point of this research is to be younger longer. So the first objection people have is, well, I don't want to be old and frail, you know, sitting in a wheelchair unable to take care of myself and that kind of thing. But that's not the point of the research. The point of the research is, in fact, to make people younger longer, not older longer. Another objection that often comes up is a fear of overpopulation. What if everybody could live 200, 300 years? Wouldn't the world become more crowded over time? And again, a demographer named Jay Olshansky has done the analysis where he basically said if we made everybody immortal tomorrow, it would take about 80 years for the world population to double at the current rates of fertility. And I believe that that would give us more than enough time to figure out what to do with regard to population if everybody did, in fact, get an extended lifespan.
Certainly the money is no small matter. A figure that I have been quoting to people ever since I read your article is that every year 25% of Medicare's budget is spent on the 5% of beneficiaries who die that year.
That's right. It's dying is very, very expensive in the United States. And again, if you could, again, some of the analysis that I did and some of the reporting I did, one of the things that you find is that if you could get people to be biologically 10 years younger than they are now, basically, let's say from 55 to 45, you could, in fact, cut the cancer rate by 80% and heart disease by 50% just by that one shift. It's essentially it would be as though you had come up simultaneously with fantastic breakthroughs for all these diseases. Merely making people 10 years younger would be a huge saving for the medical system.
You share the story here of Ida Mae Fuller, who was the first official recipient of Social Security benefits. Tell us about her.
Ida Mae Fuller was the first person to receive a Social Security check. She had basically, and her day, by the way, average life expectancy for Americans was 63 years. In any case, she got her first check after putting in $22.54 into the system, and she actually lived to be 100. And she died in the 1970s, having received about almost $23,000 worth of benefits in that time. So what we find is that since that time, since average life expectancy in the United States is now 78, basically we still had the same Social Security system that we had in place during World War II and the Great Depression. And it's becoming extremely expensive to support because people are, in fact, living longer. And if everybody lived to Ida Mae Fuller's age, the system would go bankrupt very, very rapidly.
It's interesting that no one, early on at least, thought about tracking the age of starting benefits to the average age of, you know, the average lifespan in this country.
No, it is interesting that they did not do that. And I think it's largely because here's a fascinating statistic. In 1900, the average life expectancy for an American was 47 years. That was, of course, largely because a lot of babies died before they reached age five in the United States from all kinds of infectious diseases that were rampant at the time. But also, only 1 in 20 Americans in 1900 ever made it past age 65. So what was happening in between 1900 and the time we set up the Social Security system was a huge increase in average life expectancy that was for the first time occurring. And I think that people hadn't quite brought that on board at this point. We now really expect average life expectancy to go up every year or so because of modern medicine and advances in treatments and so forth. But at the time when they set it up, I think that it was no one expected life expectancy to increase as rapidly as it in fact did.
Ronald Bailey is with us. He's science correspondent for Reason Magazine. His article, Eternal Youth for All, is the cover issue, the cover story in the March issue of Reason. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Summer Youth, with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is now open at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour to Reason Magazine science correspondent Ronald Bailey. His article, Eternal Youth for All, is the cover story of the March issue. If you'd like to join our conversation about aging and therapies to fight it, you can call 1-800-933-5372, email think at kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. I'm curious about how much all of this care will cost. Ronald, what did you learn about the sort of projected costs of things to keep us youthful as compared with the costs of treating us when we are sick with age-related diseases?
Well, one of the things that you want to do is to figure out what the value of a life year is. And fortunately, we have a lot of demographers and statisticians who've worked on that, and basically what they do is figure out how much you would be willing to pay for an extra year of life. I think there's a wonderful question, actually, that Michael Kinsley asked about that back in the New Yorker. He's was the former editor of the New Republic, for example, and he basically said, "What is it that you would not give away if you could get five extra years of healthy life?" And I think that that basically, if anybody contemplates that question, there's almost nothing that you would not give away to have that advantage to live healthily for five more years. So one of the ways that they think about this is, how much is a life year worth? It's probably worth most people about $1 million a year, or maybe $6 million a year. And so, and we find that out by the kinds of risks that people are willing to take. So if you add up all of the extra years that we now live, then over what our grandparents, for example, their average life expectancy is, it's trillions and trillions of dollars. It's probably an accumulated amount, one of the demographers has added up, something like $95 trillion in extra value of life that we've had over since World War II. So the other way to think about it, of course, is that what will happen to Medicare and to Social Security if people live a lot longer. And that would be, again, those would go up quite extensively, perhaps as much as $500 billion a year by 2060 in additional costs. But here's the way I think of it, and this is what I kind of puckishly say, and there is that if you can make me 30 again, I will absolutely promise not to take any Social Security ever. And I think most people would take that deal.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, though, if these therapies, you know, I suppose they would be administered earlier in life rather than later, if they will initially be affordable only to very wealthy Americans. So you end up with a big class divide.
Well, that's a possibility. But think of it this way. These will be experimental treatments. And think of the rich as being the experimental animals for the poor, that they will take the risks of these technologies initially. But again, if you think about it, and this is something I have looked at, is the average American, according to the projections that we have for future income in the United States, average per capita income in the United States is going to be, by the end of this century, at least $150,000 per person. And that's basically triple what it is now. And whatever the therapies are going to be, if with that kind of income, people should be able to afford those kinds of therapies, I would think.
Is there room in the workforce for people to remain there in large numbers into their 80s and beyond?
I don't. Again, one of the things that you look around at the world, the places where people live longest are also the places where the economies are most vibrant, as it turns out. The rich countries are where people have a longer life expectancy. And they're also more economically, if you will, dynamic. They have higher rates of patenting and so forth. So I don't see any problem with people remaining in the labor force. The more people who remain in the labor force, the more that we can serve each other.
It's interesting to think about the effect on the culture of a country in which very many people are older. And just to a certain extent, we're already seeing it as the baby boomers sort of reach retirement age and beyond. But I wonder how different America would feel.
That again, that's a different way of looking at it, is that, again, we're not having people being older longer. They're going to be younger longer. And I think that if you find that people are actually, you know, they're 150, but they feel 30 or so, there would be completely different sorts of people. They would not be feeling older and less and more tired and less energetic and less creative and so forth, because they will still have that energy and drive that they had when they were 30. So I don't think that we need to worry about the culture in a certain sense aging because we have more older people, because there will be actually younger people, if you get my meaning.
Mm-hmm. I have to imagine that human trials for some of these therapies are not hard to find volunteers for.
I would volunteer myself. No, I don't think that it will be. I don't think that there will be a problem finding people. One of the problems, though, with all of these particular therapies is if you are trying to rejuvenate cells and so forth, you have to be on the lookout for the possibility of also enhancing the possibility of getting cancer. And that's really where the problems will come with some of these therapies. Is that that it will unleash the cells that are now quiescent or senescent, and they might become cancerous. So that will be something people have to watch for.
So on some of these experiments, for example, like isolating the proteins in the blood of the young mice, as they have been refined, are we discovering that there's, you know, a genetic component to whether or not these therapies work on certain individuals?
There's a project called the Centenarian Project, which has basically looked at the genetics of people who live to over 95 or to 100 and so forth. And what they find is that there are differences genetically. One of the big changes seems to have to do with cholesterol and cholesterol, modulation in the body. They basically are people who have very low cholesterol over the course of their lives. And that's just one aspect of it. So there are genetic differences. There's also a test now. We were talking about telomeres earlier, the little end caps that are on each of our chromosomes. And there are now companies that test your chromosomes to see how long your telomeres are. And it is the case, if you have shorter telomeres, you are much more likely to die than if you have longer ones. And again, there are variations in people who have naturally longer telomeres than other people. So there are these kinds of things. But what they're offering us then are ways of figuring out how to develop therapies for people who are suffering these kinds of consequences. There is a company called Sierra Biosciences, for example, that is trying to figure out substances that can lengthen a person's telomeres again to a youthful youthful size, so that they will be younger and live longer. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to ask if there's still a lot of experimentation on calorie restriction, which has been talked about a lot. But most people say it sounds fantastic, but I'm not sure I want to eat, 1,000 calories a day for the rest of my life.
Yeah, that's as someone so wisely said, I actually know some people who do calorie restriction, and they are incredibly thin people, and they carry cushions to sit on because they're so thin. And they take little scales around and measure every ounce of whatever they put in their mouths. And as someone quipped about that is it may not keep you alive longer, but it'll certainly feel that way. Calorie restriction works. We know that it works on mice, for example. Again, if you restrict mice to eating about 2/3 of what they would prefer to eat, they tend to live 15 to 20% longer than mice who just eat what they want. It seems to also work in monkeys, for example. There have been a couple of rhesus monkey colonies, one in Maryland and one in Wisconsin, where they were restricted, and they had much lower rates of all kinds of chronic diseases. So that does work. So the question is, can we figure out the biochemical pathway that could mimic that? And there are, in fact, some companies working on substances that would basically trick your cells into thinking that they are starving. And the hope is that once these substances become available, that we would be able to take them as a pill and eat as much as we'd like.
I suppose whatever we settle on would have to be relatively easy because, for example, right now, most people are aware that eating right and exercising, maybe not caloric restriction, but eating right and exercising are good ways to keep yourself healthier for a longer time. And yet many people struggle to do these two things that are, you know, not incredibly onerous, but still require some effort.
Exactly. When I've talked to some of these researchers, I basically say I don't want to give up my bad habits. I want to be rescued from my bad habits.
Right. When you talk to folks about this, what tends to catch people's attention who are outside the scientific community? What things tend to interest people most?
Well, it's kind of funny because you get a response that most people actually, their first initial response is they always make the mistake of thinking they're going to get older longer. And so their initial response is, I don't want to, you know, be frail and feel out of it and lose my energy and so forth. So that's most of people are not really thinking of the benefits of becoming more youthful. They're just afraid they're going to get older. So you have to explain that to them first. That, no, the idea is that you're going to be younger again. You're going to be 30 again, not 100 again, or reach 100 and be frail. So that's one response about it. Then there's also the concern that there are people who actually, how shall I say it, they think that what will happen is society will get older. You've kind of alluded to that a bit earlier, is how that would change the culture, because what you would have is a lot of people with their old habits from, you know, from 30, 40, 50 years ago, and they would now be, if you will, clogging up the arteries of society by their old ideas and stodginess. And again, I think that would shift if people have the youthful enthusiasm that they had when they were 30, that they essentially they would be more willing to take risks even because they know they're going to have a chance to if they fail, that they will have another chance to go forward. Right now, of course, what happens is as you get older, I don't know if it was Tertullian basically said this. One of the problems is a Roman philosopher basically said the problem with ages is that they hanker after money as they get old, by which he means that what happens is that you become conscious of the fact that you need security and protection and so forth. And if you are young again, you'll be willing to take those risks. And I think that's one thing that people don't quite recognize is that if people are perpetually youthful, that we will have a more vibrant society, not a less vibrant society over time.
It certainly seems like there could be a huge infusion of wisdom into the culture. If you have people who are functioning physically like they're 30 or 40, but can be thinking in ways that reflect the benefit of, you know, 7 or 8 decades of experience, that sounds amazing.
I think that's right. And I think that, again, what happens is that the more life that people can expect to have, the more careful they will be about all kinds of things. For example, perhaps planetary protection, that people would be more concerned about taking care of the environment because they know they're going to be around for a couple hundred years.
Family dynamics would change as well. It would be really remarkable if you could think about your great-great-grandparents being around to help raise your kids.
Yes, I believe that would be an amazing experience for people. And I actually think that as Ray Kurzweil, who's a futurist who's written quite a bit on this, has pointed out, he actually thinks that the first person to live to be over 500 is already born. So that dynamic is likely to occur over the next couple of centuries.
We have an email here from Donna in Dallas who asks, at what approximate age do cells start to become senescent? Is it a gradual process throughout the body?
Well, interesting. One way to think about it is that the moment you're born, you start aging. your risk of dying continues to go up and up and up as you get older. Basically, doubles after age 20. Your risk of dying doubles every 8 years, if you will. When you're youthful, what happens is that as cells become senescent, if they become inflamed or something like that, your immune system is able to knock them out and get rid of them. As you get older, your immune system is less able to do that. More cells are becoming senescent, and they eventually overwhelm, if you will, the remaining younger, healthier cells. And that is what aging really turns into at that point.
Do our brains age at the same rate as our bodies, approximately?
Approximately. Again, there are differences in tissues. Interestingly, your brain cells last longer probably than any other cells in your body. Once your brain is developed in your 20s, those cells last a lot longer. Most of the other cells in your body turn over several times before you die, but your brain cells are there with you for most of the time.
We would also have to get people used to the idea of working longer. It wouldn't
Yes.
make sense to stop working at 65 or 70 anymore.
Correct. And again, I think that's a deal people would be happy to have, is basically if you could feel like you're 30 for 150, 200, 300 years, why in the world would you want to stop working? You would also be able to have many different careers over that time, all kinds of different training. And just think of the way the world has changed over the last century or so. I mean, we began the 20th century with essentially no automobiles, no airplanes, no air conditioning, hardly any electricity, certainly no computers, no telephones, really. And now that the world has transformed, and it's only going to get better and faster over the course of the century. So there are going to be amazing opportunities for anybody who is still alive at the end of the century. And if they're younger, there'll be even more, if you will, fun things to do with your life over that period of time.
Do you think that'll be an easy sell, though? Because I think about, you know, countries where there are really early entitlement benefits for people to stop working. And even if they feel fine, they are loath to give those up.
Well, in which case, here's the deal. Basically, if you insist on getting your benefits, you can have them, but you can't have the rejuvenation treatments.
Well, that's a hard decision, and I guess everybody would choose rejuvenation if they could.
Ronald, I think they would.
Ronald Bailey is with us. He's science correspondent for Reason magazine, and he wrote the cover story for the March issue. It's called Eternal Youth for All. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is now open at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're spending the hour with Reason magazine's science correspondent, Ronald Bailey. He wrote the cover story for the March issue. It's called Eternal Youth for All. If you'd like to join the conversation, call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go on the phone now to Denise in Bedford. Hello, Denise.
Hi.
Hi. Go right ahead, please.
Oh, thank you. I'm really kind of want to advocate for the other side, that death is not a bad thing. It's sort of a good thing in a way, because it's a kind of planned in part of the perfection. I think it was Steve Jobs who said that it was a part of nature's perfect design to allow for the old to go away so the new could replace it. And as a designer, I think he was sort of seeing that in a very positive way and not a fearsome way, that youth is the most important thing to chase after as a human being. And it just seems that it's a really wonderful, you know, thing, actually, to allow new energy to come into the world. And there are a lot of people, it sounds terrible, there are a lot of people I wouldn't necessarily want to see live to be 300 or 400 years old, but it's just a personal opinion. So I'll hang up and take my comment off the air.
Thanks for your call. What do you think about that, Ronald?
That is, again, a concern that a lot of people do express, is that they're afraid that, we've discussed it a little bit earlier already, they're afraid that people hanging on will basically somehow age, if you will, society, that the more old people, they will drain the energy and the creativity out of society. And again, I think that fear comes out of the fact that right now, when people get old, they do become less able, less creative, more stuck in their ways. But that's largely because they're feeling old. They're feeling less energetic. Whereas if people, again, I think if they really did feel 20, 30 again, they had that energy, they could look forward to many new opportunities over time, as opposed to the slow decline, both cognitive and physical, that would actually change the way society feels and the way that people feel about creativity and aging. I understand the concern, and a lot of people express that, but I think that's probably not the way it would evolve over time.
We might have to adjust things like lifetime appointments for Supreme Court justices.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yes. Basically, again, I think that people wouldn't have any particular problem with making those kinds of adjustments.
And, you know, I don't know if you're married or partnered up, but it is interesting to think about the ramifications of till death do us part if death comes, you know, a century later than we initially expected.
Again, these are the kinds of things that people would have to think about, obviously. It might be that marriage and having children and so forth become much delayed, or the marriages become, if you will, term agreements, which stay married for 30 years. These are the kinds of things that people would have to work out over that period of time. But I think people would not be reluctant to face those challenges if they could, in fact, be younger again.
Do you think that the value of the actually young would somehow be diminished by this, to the extent that right now, you know, there's something so miraculous about, you know, very young people and they fascinate us. If everybody could feel the same way as a 25-year-old, maybe we wouldn't think they were so special.
That is actually a possibility. Think about it this way. In some other stuff that I've been researching and writing, for example, one of the things that we find is that the societies where people live to, you know, have a long life expectancy, say over age 70 or so, are also those societies that have the lowest fertility rates. Mm-hmm. Basically, what anthropologists have found out, and fascinating stuff that demographers found out, is that in societies where women can expect to live, whose life expectancy is only about 50, they tend to have 6 to 8 children, whereas once women live to over age 70, they have fewer than 2. And so in a certain sense, what you're finding is that people, when they have longer lives, have fewer children. And I think that would also happen considerably. If you live to 200, you probably would delay having children for quite some time.
Well, men, unless this changes a lot, men can delay that more than women can.
Well, again, presumably, if you are able to make a person's body younger, then they would also be able to restore their fertility.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Stephen in Allen. Hi, Stephen.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me all right?
Yes, we can.
All right. I was just wondering if people live much, much longer, wouldn't that make childhood last much, much longer and maybe irresponsibility last much, much longer? Also, I was wondering, I just got in on the show. I was just wondering what this is about people feeling like they're 25, feeling like they're 25. Is that physical or is that physical and mental? And I'll turn off the phone and listen on the radio. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
With regard, the hope, again, is that people would have both the physical and mental flexibility of someone in their 20s, assuming that these therapies could work. Basically, you're rejuvenating the cells throughout your body so that you would, in fact, feel that way. With regard to childhood, I don't think that the people would like to go back to... I personally would not want to go back to being a teenager. I don't know about other people, but... I don't think that the idea is to lengthen childhood. It's basically to, if you will, lengthen adulthood.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Linda on the line in Colleyville. Hi, Linda.
Hello. I love this topic. I read an interesting science fiction trilogy about Mars. I can't remember the author's name, but it was like Red Mars, Green Mars, Blue Mars. And in it, people did have the ability to live much longer lives, up to 500 years. One of the things that they theorized, though, is that living that long, you have a limit to how much you can remember of your life. And I'm kind of wondering how living longer would affect our memories. Like, our short-term memory obviously gets a little worse as we get older, but you also tend to forget details of your early life, too. Would we have any memory of being babies or children if we lived that long?
I believe that you would be able to retain that. Part of the other thing that will happen is as the century proceeds, one other way to think about what is likely to happen is that a lot of our digital technologies will migrate into our bodies. To a certain extent, what you might think about is that a lot of your memories will be stored, if you will, on servers elsewhere, and that you'll be able to access them as though they were in your own brain. But I know that sounds very science fiction-y, but if you think about it, I've joked with my friends already, I'm 61 years old, is that thank goodness that Google came along as it did, because that's where I'm offloading most of my memory anymore.
I don't know if I offload it. I certainly find a lot there. And I was even thinking about, you know, social media, the way we store photographs, and it's not just our memories, but, you know, our friends took pictures of the same event, and those memories are stored on their pages.
Exactly, and we are accessing that kind of stuff all the time and refreshing our memories much more easily than our ancestors were able to do. So I don't think that would be a problem. Again, our brains would be younger and more flexible, and I think our memories would be actually dramatically improved.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's speak now with Gilbert in Dallas. Hi, Gilbert.
Hi. My question has to do with population control. I know this rejuvenation, I don't know how many people could afford it. I think you covered that a little bit, but how would this impact population control?
Well, again, in the article, I do quote a demographer named Jay Olshansky, who basically said, assume tomorrow that everybody on planet Earth became immortal tomorrow, what would population at current growth rates be? And it would double in about 80 years, is what he would say. And I think that essentially we go from 7 billion people to 14 billion by 2100 or thereabouts. And I think that that's a problem that people would be happy to deal with. My suspicion is, again, is if you thought you could live a very long time, several hundred years, you would, in fact, probably delay your reproduction. And I think that would really dramatically slow down population growth until we could figure out how dangerous for the planet and for resources it turned out to be. I think it's a problem that we can deal with, and I think it's a problem that we would all like to have to deal with.
Do you think, I mean, is it too late for people who are walking around right now in middle age or approaching old age?
Yes. I fear that it is. So, Ray Kurzweil, who is a director of engineering at Google and a futurist of some note, has made the argument that he thinks that we will get through what he calls longevity escape velocity in about 20 years. Essentially, what's happening now is that our life expectancy in the United States goes up 2 months for every year. And I think that's utterly unsatisfactory. His notion is what will happen is that life expectancy will increase at least a year for every year. So if that happens, it means that the technologies are coming along faster to keep you younger, longer than your risk of dying. And so he's very optimistic. He thinks it might be 20 years that we're able to achieve that. I have my doubts about that. On the other hand, I do tell my younger colleagues who are in their 20s basically that they probably will get to live as long as they want. They'll be able to choose how long they want to live.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Ginger on the line in Dallas. Hey, Ginger.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm phoning to ask, in a society...
Oh, we just lost her connection. I think she wanted to ask a question about what it will take for generations to live successfully together. And I don't know if she meant, you know, geographically. Do you imagine that there would be sort of communities of people, like everybody born in the 50s is going to, you know, live on this side of town, that sort of thing?
I don't think of it that people will be segregated by age in that way. I think that people will... I actually don't see a huge shift in the way people will behave. Again, you know, people will get to know and experience their great-great-grandparents, for example, and they will learn the wisdom from those folks as well. But again, people will have that energy, that drive that they have when they're in their 20s and 30s, and so they will be seeking opportunities wherever they can find them. So I don't think there'll be age segregation.
It's interesting to consider how long in human history we have been contemplating some kind of fountain of youth, and now maybe science gets us closer than myth and legend ever could. But it's still something that we dream about, whether or not it's entirely plausible in the future.
I think it is entirely plausible. I think that this, as probably many of your listeners know, the oldest myth that we have, the one that has come down to us, is the Gilgamesh saga from ancient Sumer. And in that saga, part of that is the goal of Gilgamesh is trying to figure out how to live forever. In fact, how to resurrect his friend Enkidu, who has died. And that is the first thing that we've got recorded in human history is the search for eternal youth. And I think that that is something that, as you pointed out, we've been searching for quite some time. And fortunately, we've gotten smart enough with the right technologies that it's likely to happen in this century.
Have you given any thought to what the perfect age would be? Like, if you could dial back the clock, would it be 24? Would it be 32? What would be the optimum age at which to freeze your physical health?
I personally would like to be 23 again.
23. Is that random, or is that just a really good year for you?
It was a really good year for me. So let's go back there.
Hmm.
What about you?
You know, I think probably early 30s. I feel like I was much more together than in my 20s. I wasn't quite finished cooking at that point.
I completely understand.
So how far into the future? You said you've told your colleagues in their 20s that they might be able to just choose how long they want to live. Are human trials imminent for some of these things that you've described that work so well in mice?
Again, for example, we talked about the GDF-11, right? The substance has been isolated from young blood that seems to rejuvenate cells. There are a couple of companies that are going to try to start using that as treatments in the next couple of years or so. And so that might be one of the first things that comes along. Again, there's this notion of longevity escape velocity, that there will be a suite of technologies addressing various aspects of aging as they come along. And as they accumulate over time, you'll be able to dial back your biological age. So, yeah, there are some technologies that are coming along. I mentioned earlier, there's another company that's working on ways to lengthen telomeres, which are the little end caps on chromosomes, which would also slow down aging if people were able to do that.
Fascinating stuff. Journalist Ronald Bailey is science correspondent for Reason magazine, where his cover story, Eternal Youth for All, appears in the March issue. He also has a book coming out this summer called The End of Doom, Environmental Renewal in the 21st Century. Ronald, I so appreciate you spending this time with us. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phone today from Celine Alba. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.